Julianne Good, and you're listening to the very first episode of Psych 101. We're going to be talking about general psychology today, and what Psych 101 is going to be about is to make psychology a little more understandable, entertaining, and hopefully a little enlightening for you. And therefore, you know, you'll be understanding a little bit more about the general world that we're going through and everything that's happening in the world right now, which is pretty interesting. Anyways, a little bit of background information about myself. Currently, I'm finishing up my master's in the Marriage and Family Therapy program at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology in downtown Los Angeles. I'm currently a practicing counselor in my practicum hours right now, and I'm working with children, adolescents, and adults, and working with domestic violence and rape issues. And today, my first guest is going to be Dr. Richard Sinicola, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about his background. He's been a practicing psychologist and therapist since 1984. In addition to having a private practice, he has been involved in higher education for more than 27 years. He's published several books and articles, including Basic Psychopharmacology for Counselors and Therapists, and Conducting Effective Mental Status and Risk Assessments. He's also the professor of clinical psychology and the MFT department at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology in Los Angeles, and conducts a private therapy and consulting practice in Pasadena, California. Thank you and welcome, Dr. Sinicola.
Great to be here.
Thank you. First of all, I would really like to know, and I'm sure that our listeners would like to know too, there's a general public opinion that only crazy people go to therapy. What's your opinion on that?
Well, probably most people would agree that there's people that should be in therapy who aren't. And I think a lot of times what we have to realize is that a lot of times people will think about therapy. They'll think about going, but they don't know if what their concern is that serious. They don't want to burden somebody. So they might ask a friend, well, should I go to therapy? You know, is my problem serious enough? So they don't really want to go and necessarily find out just how serious their problem might be. For a lot of people, they don't realize that it can be an issue of preventative mental health. If they go and talk to somebody, maybe a problem they have that is fairly minor at this point won't get any worse. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times they don't often know just how serious it is. A lot of clients will come in and say, well, okay, you've listened to me for a session or two. What do you think is going on? Am I crazy? A lot of times, you know, crazy is a relative term.
Right.
But a lot of times it's just really about, I don't know if what I have is really outside of the norm or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what is normal nowadays anyways? I mean, there's such a wide variety between normal and crazy. And they're just such relative terms that they're just thrown out like everyday terms, and nobody really knows. And I think that there is still a huge stigma on people walking around and feeling that they have a diagnosis on their heads, like they're being labeled as something other than normal. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of times being a little abnormal is a good thing. I mean, it adds to our uniqueness. There's lots of people who fall outside the norm who wouldn't necessarily be pathological. So I think...
Such as?
You know, I think people that, when you think, really creative people, people who really add to the color of society, a lot of times would walk around and people would say, oh my God, who's that freak? So I think a lot of times people have to look at, you know, what really constitutes mental illness. Mm-hmm. When does being abnormal, if you will, create a problem for the person?
And that's a good question. What would you say would be the signs and symptoms that a person would need to go to therapy, that things are a little out of place in their lives?
Well, years ago, the same question was asked of Freud. And I think his answer is probably applicable today. And that is, you know, if you've got issues in love and work, then you might need to talk to somebody. So when clients come in and they say, you know, when do I know that my issue has crossed that line? And I'll ask, does it interfere with the relationships you have? Does it keep you from having a relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Can you function? Can you work? And by work, I don't mean, you know, can you put in 9 to 5 at Trader Joe's? I just mean, you know, can you do something productive during the day that you feel good about and that you think contributes in some way? So if you can't work, if you can't be creative, if you can't love, if you can't have relationships, then it might be worth talking about what's going on in your life.
Right. And institute a, you know, somebody who's trained in trying to get a person back to at least a functioning level. Mm-hmm. And something that's, you know, where they're going to be able to feel like, you know, they're not waking up in the morning and going, oh, I just don't want to be going to work or school, or I'd rather just, you know, hide out in bed, or, you know, whatever pathology they may be going through and symptoms and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So now that, you know, you brought up a good point about, you know, gauging what is normal and, you know, with gauging your relationships with other people. And I think one of the things that's happening now is that people are isolating much more. I mean, what would you recommend to a person that is doing that more and more?
Well, of course, some people are by nature introverts and some are extroverts. I think the mistake we made so many years ago, and we've certainly made this mistake in education, is that we wanted everyone to be extroverts. And so we created environments where introverts couldn't really function very well. You know, we would say you're being, you know, the old lay term antisocial. Of course, we have a different meaning for antisocial. Mm-hmm. We'll use the word non-social. So you take someone who's non-social, more introverted, and of course you might believe them to be somehow pathological because they're not playing well with others.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now we know better. We know that there's two different kinds of people, and they're going to blossom when you put them in an environment that, you know, complements who they are. And I think a lot of people, though, are by nature extroverts, but we live in a very technological age now where it's so easy not to have contact with others.
Mm-hmm.
We don't live in homes with big front porches anymore. We don't play baseball in the street anymore. You don't invite your neighbors over. At best, you might wave at your neighbor, but most people, if you ask them who are your neighbors, they don't know.
Exactly.
they simply say, well, I think there's a family living next door. At least that's what I saw,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the driveway. So I think by nature, when you start to think of, well, who are your friends? Who are you trying to connect with? People are connecting with strangers on the internet, and or they'll talk in terms of how many friends they have, how many electronic friends they have. Of course, they don't know any of them very well.
Right, and it's just a number.
Yeah, it's a number. And the larger the number, the more you should feel good about yourself.
Mm-hmm. So would you say then that you would think that we're having more mental illness and issues and problems because we're losing that basic connection with each other?
Well, I think certainly people are feeling more alienated. Because constantly in therapy, I will ask this question of people, who do you trust? And people are hard-pressed to answer that question. They really don't know. And then I'll say, well, tell me about the people in your lives. And I always hear things like, well, I don't have any friends, or I've lost contact with my friends. Well, why is that? Well, we're all so busy. We're all working 50 hours a week, and it's just so hard. I mean, I might shout out to them on Facebook and say, hey, love the shoes, or, you know, whatever, but they don't make a point to actually call them. I mean, there's a novel idea. Actually call someone on your smartphone. Don't just send
right.
them a like, you
yes.
know, or send them this obscure, you know, text message. And then when you respond, nothing. And sometimes the nothing will go on for weeks.
Right. Or what we're seeing now is people that are talking to each other, but they're texting each other next to each other or across the table, or, you know, I mean, I think that's an amazing phenomenon right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, you're with somebody, but you're not really with somebody. You're just there in just one essence, but you're electronically someplace else.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, these intrusions into our personal space of electronic devices, some people can handle that very well. They keep their cell phone or their smartphone in their purse or in their briefcase. But there's some people that are actually out to dinner with people they're trying to impress. And it's just too tempting if they hear that little tone that somebody just sent them a text or an email. They have to immediately stop what they're doing and read it, even though it's alienating the other person.
Mm-hmm. And as a clinician, why do you think that this is happening so much?
Well, I think it's, if you think about it, there's always going to be intrusions into our lives. It's how we deal with them. Recently, I was talking to some colleagues who told me that they had to remind themselves as clinicians not to think of emails coming in while they were talking to clients. And it's interesting that, a few months ago, we kind of got this little note from the insurance company saying, oh, by the way, don't forget to turn off your smartphones and cell phones while you're seeing patients, because apparently there were some complaints even about therapists, mm-hmm. Saying, don't look at your screen while you're talking to somebody. And make sure you don't, it's kind of like the age old, we were taught many, many years ago, not to ever answer the phone during a session.
Right.
But so we got used to voicemail, the phone would ring once and it would go to voicemail. But it's different when the phone is halfway across the room and you can't get to it. But if the cell phone or the smartphone's in your hand and you feel it vibrating, it's almost like beckoning you, it's calling your name. And some people have a hard time just, turning it off. And just attuning to the person in front of them.
Right. I think it's an art that we're starting to lose a little bit out on, mm-hmm. What would you recommend to listeners to start making that reconnection with each other, with the person that's next to you, whether it's your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend or, your friend, just the persons that are the most important to you in your life? What would you recommend for reconnecting?
I think there's two little things you can do that make all the world a difference. And one is eliminate distractions, whatever those are. And, people say, well, how can I do that? We've got 5 kids at home. And I say, well, even couples that have children have to identify what I call an adult night out, mm-hmm. where they get a sitter. And they pick a place and they go out to dinner, even if it's for a couple of hours, of adult conversation and one-on-one. So how are you doing? Not how are the kids doing or what did Billy do today and what did Janie do today? It's really about us as a couple. So eliminate the distractions. Go out to dinner. Turn off the cell phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that important. I tell people all the time, what is really that important that you have to constantly have this electronic feed telling you every 2 minutes what somebody's doing? Most people don't have those kind of emergencies and don't need that kind of information. The other thing is to change up the routine. If you've got an evening at home where you don't have to be anywhere, most people will default into passive activities. They will just simply flip through television channels or, they'll find something to do. They'll go surf on the net or something. Instead, what could you do with the other person?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times what happens is people connect under unusual circumstances. There'll be a storm and the power will go out. So they have to sit there in the dark with candles and they end up talking about things that they haven't talked about in a long time. Maybe it's about doing something completely different. Like, we're going to play a board game tonight. That's like a board game.
What's that?
like Monopoly or Yahtzee and they do it. And it always happens. At the end of the evening, they're laughing and they're carrying on and they're like, wow, I really connected with you over this silly board game, because you have to participate with the other person in a board game.
Mm-hmm.
You have to watch what they're doing. You have to think about what you're doing. You have to respond to what they're saying. That's all part of the game.
It's being in the here and now.
Yeah. In the moment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think part of it too is we're losing touch with our basic selves, the essence of who we are personally, what we're feeling, what we're thinking, instead of just, somebody coined it really nice. We're not human doings, we're human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we really forget to do that a lot. We just get so caught up in what's going on in the outside world and what our responsibilities and bills and, you know, trying to be as adult as possible and taking care of everything. And, you know, most people, I think, go to bed and they're just exhausted because it's just too much happening. So what would you recommend to just get back in touch with your own self, with, you know, who am I really underneath all of this?
Right. Well, one technique I've used with patients before, with clients, is to have them become much more aware of what their week really looks like. And to do this, we'll have them take a bunch of sheets of paper and some colored markers. And I'll say, okay, I want you to fill up this sheet, which is basically from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed. And I want you to use these markers and mark out things, give a color to something that's an obligation, something that's work-related, something that's school-related, something you have to do for the kids or for your spouse or partner, and then how much of it is actually leisure. And what they find out is that they actually have very little time that's really theirs, and they end up not planning their time. It's a default time. Well, I've got a half an hour here. I'll just lay here because I'm exhausted and I just don't want to think. Or I've got 2 hours before I go to bed, and so I didn't plan any of this out. I'm just going to sit here and flip through channels, not really watching anything. So we have our leisure time ends up being just really default time. But if you really look at our time and you realize how much is carved out, you realize that if you really want to have some time where you're connecting with somebody else, you might actually have to create it. You might actually look at your week and say, all right, you know, I really don't need to do this one thing that I could give up. And instead, me and my significant other are going to work on this. Or if I want to connect with my kids, I need to make time. And it doesn't necessarily mean let's fill up their schedule with more busy stuff. Let's take some more dance lessons. Let's take another ballerina class. Let's take another soccer. Let's be on two soccer teams, because that may not necessarily be the kind of time you're trying to create.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's just, again, it's the doing and getting a visual of what does my life look like on a schedule, you know, versus just looking at it and it's just a blur.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just taking a moment and maybe doing some deep breathing and going, where am I going with this? And then sometimes just realistically looking at it and going, wow, I can't believe that I'm doing this much. Why am I doing this? And then stepping back and taking inventory, I think is really important. I think people are just forgetting to do that now, or they're not realizing how really important that is.
Oh, yeah. Because when we talk about doing like career counseling, there's something called doing a leisure plan. And that term always kind of takes people back when they hear it. They go, leisure? Why would you plan leisure? Doesn't that defeat the purpose? And I'll say, well, leisure without a plan is default time. And it ends up turning into something that when you get to the end of the week, you look at your leisure time and you go, what a bunch of wasted time. You know, I literally was just like flipping through magazines, looking at ads because I just didn't want to do any obligatory, you know, activities. But a leisure plan is really taking the time to say, all right, if I've got 4 hours a week of time for me, what do I want it to look like? I don't want to look at my whole week and see the markers and say, if all of the green areas are stuff I have to do, and my whole week just looks totally green, it's all blocked out, then you wonder why you're exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
So you really do have to create little pockets of leisure time and plan it out. And ask yourself just that very question you were just mentioning. You know, what do I want my week to look like? What do I want my leisure time to look like? And what purpose do I want it to have? Do I want it to enhance how I feel about myself? Do I want it to enhance the relationships I have with people around me? Well, then I've got to plan it out.
Exactly. And it's getting back to balancing. You know, and I think as Americans, we're just so almost brainwashed to like, we've got to work, 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 work. You know, and leisure time is almost a dirty word. Oh, vacation? Well, really? You're going to take vacation? Forget it. We've got A, B, and C. And so many people nowadays are afraid of losing their jobs.
Yes.
And therefore, they're going on overdrive, trying to prove themselves to their companies that they are worthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it creates a complete imbalance. You know, and it's no wonder why people are just, you know, they're exhausted. They're not really dealing with their problems. Their friends and family are exhausted too. So, I mean, it gets back to the point of everybody needs to have somebody that they can really, totally, honestly talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, here comes the psychotherapy again. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the different theories and techniques about the different schools of psychotherapy.
Sure. Yeah, I think the key thing is to go back for a second to what you were talking about with leisure. The goal here is not to to work harder. It's to work smarter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that leisure does not equal laziness. And in a lot of people, especially in our American work ethic, leisure and vacation was always like a dirty word. You know, people would say, where's so-and-so? Well, he's on vacation. It was always like, ugh. I hate him, you know, probably because you haven't taken any vacation days in like years and you lost them all.
Exactly. They need it.
Yes. But as a culture, we're the only culture in the world that doesn't use our vacation time, most of us. And we're all guilty of it. You know, we're in this work ethic where you constantly have to be producing. And if you take leisure time or vacation time, you're somehow being lazy or slacking off. And that's not what we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about how can I work smarter, not harder, not longer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and incorporating that into the psychotherapy end of it.
Yes,
if somebody's coming to see you, and now what kind of techniques are available out there?
Well, there's lots of schools of thought. I think one thing we can safely say is that when a person has a concern or an issue that would respond well to therapy, it really doesn't matter what school of thought is used or employed, that any school of thought or any therapy is better than no therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But there are what we call, for lack of a better word, evidence-based treatment models. And these are ones that, you know, have shown through research and through testing of various means to be more effective than other approaches of therapy. And I think we can see that, you know, traditionally, all therapies kind of grew out of three major forces or systems, if you will. You know, there was the behavioral, which kind of grew out of the whole behaviorism movement, you know, the operant and classical conditioning, behavior mod, and then that mutated over the years into approaches like cognitive behavioral therapy, and rational emotive behavior therapy. These were all kind of, you know, if you will, mutations from those original behavioral therapies. And then you have ones that kind of grew out of the psychoanalytic movement, both Freudian and Jungian. And the neo-Freudian movements, you know, the psychodynamic psychotherapy, which was less about being analyzed on a couch and more about employing those psychodynamic approaches in a face-to-face, you know, patient-oriented kind of approach.
Mm-hmm. So that was more like the you know, the basis, like late 1800s. Early 1900s,
mm-hmm.
like Freud and Jung, and
sure, as people that they in fact trained moved on, and the neo-Freudians kind of took on a new flavor where they were a little bit more interactive and a little less analytical, but they still use those tenets of psychodynamic psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, really in the late 40s, early 50s, that whole humanistic, patient client centered approaches that grew, Rogerian and the existential movement as well, where it was really about what the patient wanted. You know, all of these approaches are in fact helpful. But I think in terms of today, if from a consumer-driven standpoint, people are looking for a little faster route to feeling better.
Right.
So that's where they look to the evidence-based models and say, okay, put all these, all things considered equal, put them all in a continuum, and how will I know which ones will help me address my concerns maybe a little faster than the traditional route.
Mm-hmm. And being here, in therapy for years and years like Woody Allen.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and I think Woody would keep going even if he was doing better. He just
exactly. Just so I can make another movie.
It's a part of his leisure plan.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, different clients would require different types of therapy. So say that you've got a relatively mild to moderate issue or problem. What would you recommend which route that they go? What kind of therapist do you think that they should be seeking out?
Well, that's always the thing that most people don't know. Now some people come and they're veterans of therapy and they kind of know what's helped them. And they might have, for example, moved to Los Angeles. So they're trying to find a therapist who is kind of like the therapist they saw back east. And so they want someone who kind of adheres to that school of thought. But a lot of times if people are novices to psychotherapy, they really don't know what it is that they need. And they don't really know how bad their issue or how severe it is. So a lot of times they'll come in and they'll be confused. And they'll be talking, especially in that first session, they're kind of rambling. And they'll often stop me and go, oh my God, I'm rambling. Are you getting everything? And I said, oh no, keep going. You know, they don't realize that I'm picking up things as they go along. They think they're rambling, but I in fact am getting a sense of what approach might actually work for them. So it's okay to be more eclectic. I think, you know, I consider myself what I would call more of a technical eclectic, which is having training in several different areas and knowing when to employ that particular technique or what approach, what school might best help this client with this type of problem.
Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of different tools that you can access for whatever presenting problem that they have.
Right.
And you know, therefore you can say, well, you know, I can really help you with this or that, or, you know, and it's nice to be able to have that kind of background that pretty much anybody that walks through your door, you feel that you can help and be of service to. And I think for a lot of people, just even, you know, getting to that point where it's like, you know what, you know, things are not going right. I'm not having the support. I need to change things. What would you recommend to somebody that's kind of at the point of, yes, I need therapy, but I don't know what the first step I need to take is?
Well, a lot of times I'll tell them, don't worry about what's supposed to happen here. Don't worry whether you get it all in 50 minutes or not. You know, come in and talk about what you think the concern is. And then together we'll kind of figure out where you think this is leading you. A lot of times at the end of the first session, I'll say, you know, how was this for you? You know, how do you feel about it? And a lot of times they'll say, you know what, it was kind of remarkably easy. At first when I came in, I was feeling inhibited and I didn't think I would tell you why I came in, but it just started to roll out of my mouth. And the more I talked, and as you asked questions, the more I told you things. And I probably told you things that my friends and family don't know. But sometimes that's I think you and I had talked about this at one time. It's like being the friendly stranger, and it's sometimes easier to tell that stranger things than it is to tell other people. But what happens in therapy really that is the curative factor is the fact that as you're telling me, you're telling yourself and you're hearing it sometimes for the first time.
Exactly. Because I think sometimes people are not used to even hearing their own voices telling their own truth. And it's just an amazing process to watch. And all of a sudden, sometimes it's just like, I can't believe I just said that. And you know, you see a light bulb go off of their head and they're like, okay, I guess you kind of got a little inkling of really understanding what's going on inside of yourself again, mm-hmm. you know, versus just burying it all. Yeah. So what would you recommend that a person does to start taking those steps towards working with a therapist? I know that there's a lot of therapists out there and it can just be like an overwhelming process, just sitting there and trying to pick through, okay, well, who's going to sit here and really, you know, figure me out in a short amount of time and whom I could feel comfortable with.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of times people will think, well, how should I choose a therapist? I mean, should I choose a therapist like I choose a plastic surgeon, you know, where I want to get, the plastic surgeon of the stars or, pick the best graduate school that they came from? But sometimes those aren't the best predictors of anything. Psychotherapy is a very personal experience. It's a personal relationship, and it has to be about fit. And one thing is clear when they've done research over and over again, and they've even asked therapists, what do you look for in a therapist? And they always come back with the same two criteria. And those are, one, the person has to be warm. And two, they have to be competent. Because you can get someone who's very competent and knows a lot of things, but if you can't have a rapport with them, if you can't have a relationship with them, you aren't going to trust them, and you're not going to want to visit with them, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So those two essential features must be there. And if that's there, trust will happen, and the relationship will begin. It's really a relationship, but unlike any relationship they have, it's not a friendship. It's not a collegial work-related relationship. It is very unique.
And how would you say that that's the most unique to those other relationships that the person may or may not have?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's because they don't have these relationships. You know, they'll even come in and they'll mention that they're dating somebody. And a lot of times you might think, because they've been dating the same person for 6 years, that they would be close. Oh, but it couldn't be further from the truth. Because when you begin to ask them about this significant person in their life, they really can't tell you much about him or her. And then you begin to hear from them how lonely the relationship really is, that they're really not connecting at all, and that they're often questioning whether they should continue to have that relationship with the person. Or they're estranged from their family. Sometimes they haven't talked to parents or siblings in years. And not because they're angry with them or they fought. They just never connected them with them in the beginning. They never felt that their parents or caregivers were really there for them. So they feel like they walk around with all of these superficial relationships. And now here is the challenge. You're the first person that's really getting to a deeper level with them. And it can have a profound effect on them.
Right. And it's, it's also an attachment issue too,
mm-hmm.
because I know some of the women that I worked with over at the domestic violence shelter was like, they were like, I can't talk to anybody. I'm not allowed to talk. All I'm allowed to do is A, B, and C, and I just stuff everything inside of me. And they've learned to do, some of them learned to do that from early childhood on. Mm-hmm. And it's just a consistent pattern of disconnection in their lives.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think as a beginning therapist myself, it's teaching them skills to be able to talk again, to just be able to just state basic needs and wants. And mm-hmm. that is a challenge, you know, the education part of it. And just allowing them to be who they are with mm-hmm. us is, I think, incredibly empowering.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And especially for victims of abuse, you know, they were never allowed to have needs and wants. It wasn't ever about them. And so that's hard for them because here they are in a situation in therapy where someone is really asking them, what is it that you want? That's like the hardest question for them to answer.
Right, especially if they have children and husbands or significant others that they're taking care of. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them haven't even thought about what they want on a daily basis. You know, to them, it's just, you get that deer in the headlight look from them sometimes. You're just like, oh, okay, so, you know, and then again, it's sitting down. It's having them write out their goals. And mm-hmm. some of them are even just terrified to just do the writing.
Yes.
So it's trying to find techniques that are going to get them back in touch with what they, just their basic human needs and wants are.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's so difficult for them to do, because even when you tell them, tell me what your wants are, what you hear in every one of those is not about them. It's what they want for other people that they have to take care of.
Right.
And so they want their kids to be happy. They want their kids to be taken care of. They want a place for the kids to grow up. They want to please a parent or a significant other. But it's not really for them. So it's really hard. You have to redirect them constantly back to, what do you want? What do you want that's only for you? Can you articulate that? That's tough.
It is tough. And I think all of us need to ask that of ourselves. What do I really need and want?
Mm-hmm.
Just for, even if it's just for today, even if it's just in this moment,
mm-hmm.
you know, where am I? And how does this fit in the big wide world here? You
sure.
know, I mean, we were talking before too about, you know, and part of the therapy thing with existential therapy, which I think is really interesting. It's kind of getting back into that essence of, where do I fit in the world? Can you talk a little bit about existential?
Sure. Existentialism is really about understanding where you are, where you fit. It helps to address those big questions that we all have about life, which is, who am I? Why am I here? And where am I going? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of those we really can't answer. But it's the not knowing that makes people kind of crazy when they think about it. And the biggest concern that people come in from an existential point of view is this whole concept of worrying about existence. It's the question of, I'm feeling, we call it existential neurosis. It's the if you will, the result of living causes this. You know, it's the going through every day and wondering, okay, what am I doing all of this for? I'm working so that I can save for retirement, but then I'm going to worry about whether I have enough money when I retire. And if I don't think I do, I'll be working till I'm 90. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just keel over dead. And so it'll all be for naught.
Right.
And in existentialism, one of the key elements, one of the key fears that really drives all this is the fear of death, is the fear of non-existence.
Or in getting to the point where if we get up to the point of death and looking back with regrets, you know, I think that is there's a key element of being filled with regrets. Oh, I didn't do this. I didn't do that. I didn't accomplish this. I wasn't a millionaire or, you know, famous or whatever, you know, and getting into that superficiality of I wasn't big enough mm-hmm. in my life. Mm-hmm. So therefore I, you know, you're right. What was it for? What, you know, where do we go with this? So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So your client base over the years, how has it changed or has it changed?
It probably really hasn't changed that much in terms of what people bring to the session. I think that, you know, certainly depression, anxiety, and substance abuse issues are probably the big three, or any combination thereof. But I think relationship concerns, people trying to define for themselves what is love and how will I know that I'm loved? How will I know that I'm making a connection with others? That's certainly a big presenting issue that people bring. And that really hasn't changed over the years. I think if anything has changed, it's probably the consumer mentality about the delivery system. I think years ago when I first started practicing, people expected therapy to be a long endeavor. And they were willing to kind of bunker down and go on for the long haul and the long ride. And I think we see a little less of that today. People are a more savvy customer. So they come in and they've already read several books on therapy. And they'll ask questions like, well, what do you think of this guy? And what do you think of that guy and this author? And so they come in, they're a little bit more of a worldly customer.
So they've done their research probably a lot on the internet.
Absolutely, and, yeah. Yes. And so they kind of know the information is available there. So they come in or they'll come in and they'll say, well, I want this kind of therapy and I want it to be this long. And so you do your best to accommodate and to explain the process because that's certainly, that part has changed. We can't just simply go under the aura that is the therapist's office. Many years ago, people would come in and it was almost as if it was a secret society and you were the Wizard of Oz and, you know, do not look behind the curtain. And, you know, so, but now it's a little different. We not only show them behind the curtain, but we show them all the little bells and whistles and how we make the smoke and the mirrors and all that. So they're a little bit more of a savvy customer. We tell them there are no surprises. What you see is real and it's, you know, and you can ask anything.
Mm-hmm. And I think nowadays too, a lot more therapists are willing to show a little more humane side of themselves and not like, you know, like Hollywood has done the Freudian thing where they're sitting behind the couch and they're laid behind the couch and the therapist is writing down their notes and not saying anything. And, you know, I think that's definitely changing. I don't know a whole lot of therapists that do that technique anymore. I'm sure they're out there, but, you know, I think they're just a lot more willing to be open and, like you said, warm before. And, you know, it's like, we're both human. We both have faults. We both are going through problems. We have challenges. We're here to talk about it. We're here to get your life to a more stable position so that you can go out and be happy, you know, and just experience all you can in your life. And the beautiful thing is too, I, you know, with like Bowen family therapy, it's like, you don't need to see the whole family to affect the whole family system if just one person comes in, because one person can sit and change the whole system. If they sit there and say, you know what, I've had enough. I need to change this because, you know, whatever behavioral problems I'm having, it's affecting everybody around me.
That's,
you know,
right.
And it's just, you know, I like the saying that depression is the common cold of psychology. Because it seems like that is a huge presenting problem right now. There are so many people walking around that, you know, may not be clinically depressed. They may be having some situational problems coming up, or they may have full-blown depression. But it's like it's such a common occurrence nowadays. What do you think is triggering off this whole common cold scenario of psychology?
Well, I think let's face it, I think the world is changing, and in some ways there's some remarkable things that are going on and there's some remarkable discoveries, and I think we're always evolving, but some things are being lost in the process. I think, you know, we all are getting busier, the expectations are greater, people are trying harder to realize those expectations, and what unfortunately happens is many people get lost along the way. A lot of people can't keep up with this gerbil wheel that is life, and they become fatigued. And I think the fatigue is, the depression is often an extension of that fatigue. It's not really knowing, you know, how am I going to keep going? How do I create balance? They don't know how to create the balance.
Yeah, or keep hope alive.
Yes. What do they have to look forward to?
Right. Exactly. And, you know, planning ahead and just taking a moment to breathe, taking a moment to sit there and say, where is my life going?
Mm-hmm.
What's really important to me? Because I need to start with me first.
Yes, absolutely.
Because again, it just, you affect everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether you're happy or you're sad, it's just, it's contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's really interesting to watch that whole effective thing going on. And, you know, and I think a lot of people don't even realize that because a lot of people are so consumed in their own heads. And again, you're right. We're just too busy. We're too inundated with technology and to-do lists.
Yes.
So what would you recommend to the listeners to even take one baby step to changing that pattern?
Well, I think if you just take a moment and you really put down everything that you do in the course of a week and you look at it and you say to yourself, oh my God, no wonder I'm tired. No wonder I'm exhausted. But then if you literally go through every one of those and ask yourself, is this something that must remain? And if it's here, it has to serve a purpose. Now, some things are things we can't necessarily get away from. You can't just say, well, you know, I think I'll just quit my job so that I can create much more big blocks of leisure time. I mean, if you can do that, great, but most of us can't. But, you know, you really need to become consciously aware of what you're doing on a daily basis, not simply just trudge through like a robot. You need to really stop and say, am I fully aware of how I spend my time? And how can I reshape this? How can I create some blocks of leisure that mean something to me? And then ask yourself, what have I done for myself in the last year that really was about me growing as a person? Did I give up my hobbies? You know, have I lost my identity somewhere here? I'm simply an employee of this corporation, and nothing really defines me as unique. So the things that I used to do, whether it was painting or composing or playing tennis or whatever it might have been, is lost, is gone. And with it, your identity.
Exactly. I think you're right. We are losing the uniqueness of our own selves, of you know, what makes me tick, what makes me happy, what makes me ecstatic at times. You know, it's... I think, you know, now doing that kind of charting like that, somebody sits there and looks at that, and then all of a sudden they start getting emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've seen that happen with some of my clients, within them just bring in their homework, and all of a sudden they start reading it, and they start going through that realization, and then all of a sudden they become a little uncomfortable with it. So, mm-hmm. You know, maybe again, it's just being... you know, realizing that you might have an emotional reaction,
mm-hmm.
to realistically looking at your schedule, realistically looking at what am I truly doing with my time that I'm awake.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even, you know, even with the sleep, you know, problems and stuff that we are having in this country right now, so many people with having sleep issues. And there's another problem that's put on there. Can you talk a little bit about sleep issues?
Oh, sure. It's a very common problem. I mean, most Americans have a sleep disturbance at one time or another in their life. And some people chronically have them every night. And assuming that we've removed the obstacles, you know, that are primary sleep disorders that people might have, like sleep apnea or, you know, restless leg syndrome, etc. A lot of people, the sleep is disturbed because the philosophy that they have of constantly being productive continues into the evening. It exudes itself into what should be your mandatory rest time. So when they get home, they can't turn it off. They go to bed and they begin to obsess and they begin to worry. Did I do this today? Did I get enough done? Did I call this one? Did I please enough people? Oh, did I make sure that I set this up for tomorrow? Because if I get to work and this isn't done, someone's going to be pissed at me. So they can't even allow themselves to have a period of rest, of downtime. And because of this, it usually causes what we call initial insomnia, that inability to relax. And it's so... when you talk to patients and you say, how long does it take you to fall asleep? sometimes they'll say, well, how long does it take you to fall asleep? Almost like it's like a challenge. It's like, you know, none of us are falling asleep, and you must not be either. So when you explain to them that a normal average person falls asleep within a few minutes, they think that you're lying to them. They'll say, well, I don't know. I'll lay there for half an hour. If I'm lucky, within 45 minutes, I'll fall asleep. Or I'll get up and have to do a couple more things, and then I'll go to sleep. They think that that's normal, mm-hmm. and it's not. That shouldn't be happening. So sleep disturbance is a big problem for many people.
And that's part of that balance program. That's probably one of those things that should be put on the schedule of, let's look at my week. Let's, you know, we'll throw in, you know, what are my sleep patterns like? Am I getting enough sleep, or am I getting up in the middle of the night and obsessing, or, you know, I mean, that's such an important part of it too. It's just, yeah. You know, so yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's really sad that patients will actually have what we call middle insomnia, where they'll wake up in the middle of the night. Sometimes it's because they have a bad dream, and sometimes they don't know why they wake up, and usually it's because of anxiety or depression. But then they actually feel guilty if they don't use that as productive time. So they'll actually get up out of bed, turn on their laptop, and begin answering emails from work so that they can log that in as productive time when they should be sleeping.
Right. So we go back to the hamster cycle again on the wheel. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, at this point, I'm going to wrap up the show. I would like to thank Dr. Richard Sinicola for his time.
And
if you would like to contact him, he is in the Pasadena, California area. His phone number is 626-395-9491. Again, that's 626-395-9491. He also has a website set up in the Psychology Today section. If you Google Psychology Today, he'll be in the Pasadena psychologist area. You can view his profile there. He also has an email link. And if you want to talk to him, he does give free 5-minute and just 5-minute assessments. Mm-hmm. But then you can talk to him in person. And my contact is jgood1111@hotmail.com. It's jgood1111@hotmail.com. And contact us. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to be back here next week again. My goal is to educate you listeners as much as possible. That would be wonderful, because I think that this is some really interesting, important information that I have to pass on. It's going to be a different theme every week. And I'm going to have different professionals in here. I'm also going to be having musicians and artists in here talking about creating from a psychological perspective. So I hope you join me again on Monday from 7 to 8. If you ever want to call in, the number for Skid Row Studios is 1-800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And the address is www.skidrowstudios.com. And it's www.skidrowstudios, and that's one word, .com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio. So give us a call, and I'd love to hear from you again. Thank you so much. This is Julianne Good with Psych 1-on-1. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Good night.